Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Comics Fondle, the podcast. My name is Andrew Wickliffe. My blog is comicsfondle.com, and this is its podcast. With me, I have...
It's me, Vernon Wiley, a proud proprietor of the Comics Gallery, a fine arts and comics buying establishment in Wilmette, Illinois.
And this is our second podcast monthly. We had some time, so we were able to come back last month, and now we're back this month with some more comics.
Yeah.
Including, we're just going to get right into the floppy discussion, and we're going to start out with, you know... The book, one of the books that we talk about the most on a Wednesday night, because nobody saw this coming. Nobody saw Hanna-Barbera's DC titles being some of DC's better work.
Well, especially as part of their rebirth, it's kind of like, wow, those are the most successful of the rebirth titles so far, just because they fit and they work within the confines of the structure and just kind of take it and run with it, you know, and they're having fun.
We're talking about Wacky Raceland here. We talked about Scooby-Doo and Future Quest last episode. So, yeah, it's Wacky Raceland, which is by who? I mean, it's not even... Do you have that written down handy?
I've got it handy. I just got to turn the page over here in the antique land. But you know what? As true as it comes, it's not on the first or second page. Pontac is listed as the writer.
And Manco, that's right, it was Leonardo Manco doing the art. That's kind of how you got me convinced I should look at it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's probably one of the better, what do you call him, traveling artists. You know,
it's so weird because he, as far as I know, he never did a Vertigo book. But now he's doing Wacky Raceland, which I
don't know. He might have done some Hellblazer.
Maybe he did some Hellblazer, but later. But when he was a... When I think of when he first started doing comics, early 2000s, late 90s, he was almost exclusively at DC. He did, or at Marvel, did he do the Kents at DC?
Oh, man, that's a toughie. I remember him doing some work at Marvel in DC, mostly with licensed tie-in kind of stuff, and kind of like fading out of the history for a bit. You know, but he's like one of those...
Yeah, he went away, and now he's kind of back,
Yeah, he's one of them workhorse European guys, or Spanish guys. I'm not sure what his background is, but the guy just cranks it out and puts so much detail into everything.
It's so cool. I mean, because this one is...
Warning, it's not for kids.
Yeah, he did do a bunch of Hellblazer, but I got to know him on his sort of Marvel horror, which was a very weird thing.
Stephen King adaption stuff or whatever?
I think, you know, he ended up doing Hellblazer at Boom, didn't he? I think he did that, and that got me to read one issue, and then Hellblazer stopped me. But or maybe I read more. I can't remember. But, I mean, this one is Wacky Raceland, and I wrote about this, is sort of this wonderful mix of not just comics and Hanna-Barbera, but just it's Mad Max. It's Warner Brothers doing everything, you know? They're doing their comic, they're doing their cartoon, and they're doing a riff on the Mad Max while it's zeitgeist. But it's this action-packed, post-apocalyptic Death Race 2000 thing with giant monsters and just...
Lots of death and visceral affection.
It's just awesome. I can't believe that they... I mean, if we'd known that this was what was going to be in it, we might not have made fun of... I mean, that was the thing, is everybody made fun of Hanna-Barbera comics. We all made fun of them when they announced this 6 months ago.
Yeah, it was the hottest thing to, like, make gossip on. Like,
right, you were just like, what the hell are they doing?
Right.
They should just close DC now, you know? Like, they suck. But, I mean, this is... And if it weren't coming at Rebirth, like, this is the kind of thing DC... You know, a smaller DC imprint succeeding that's actually good, that doesn't happen very often. Like, there was the, they tried the Focus line, or whatever that was called, that Hard Time was part of, about 12 years ago, the Vertigo books that were all ages, or weren't graphic, and Hard Time was the only one that was any good, and or yeah. some, one of the other ones was okay, but it wasn't like good enough, and some of them were bad, and it's just like, so they finally figured out how to do this. It's just like, they finally figured out comics have gotten to the point where you can actually do good, gritty Hanna-Barbera reboots.
Well, Hanna-Barbera and the words Mad Max, and you squish them together, and it just you're not sure it's going to work, but you know, these guys just seamlessly throw it together and make it like this. It would be a great movie to see this.
Uh-huh. I know.
This would be a great B movie. If who's the director of Mad Max?
George Miller.
If Miller did this, you know, if he could do Mad Max at like 70 something years old, he could certainly do Wacky Raceland. I mean, I'd be all over that shit. It's just good stuff.
Yeah, and it's who's this guy who wrote it? Ken Pontac.
You know, I don't know who the guy is. He seems like he's been around for a while because he knows how to do structure. And he's true to the material. I mean, he seeks in all the childhood favorites and gives him this grisly makeover. He seems like one of the European guys. In fact, this whole thing looks like a Titan or 2000 AD comic book. You know what I mean?
You know what? He writes cartoons.
Really?
This is his first kind of comic, it looks like.
Well, he gets it on this one anyway.
Yeah, he wrote a Justice League Unlimited. And then this, yeah. So he gets it, and it's interesting to have that approach to it. Yeah, he's not a young Turk. He's a grown up. That's kind of
yeah.
cool. Yeah,
yeah. It's kind of worked out. That's one for one for Bob. Or was it no? That see, we liked kind of liked it. Something Quest, was it called? Future Quest?
Future Quest was...
It was all right.
It was all right. Scooby-Doo's been
it was more.
Fun.
It was. It's less acceptable now that we've seen Scooby-Doo and Wacky Race.
And then Flintstones is this week, right?
What's that?
Is Flintstones this week?
Yes, I got to look at it. I didn't get to read it yet, but it's got Stephen Pugard all over it. Or Pug, or whatever his name
Pug.
Is.
Pug, nice. How come DC can do Hanna-Barbera relaunch better than they can do Rebirth? But anyway...
About the Hanna-Barbera titles, so the guys have fun doing them. It's
right.
not a corporate dictate. It's like, hey man, just like do whatever the fuck you want and don't make it X-rated and we'll be on board. Because incidentally, I don't know, Future Quest can be all ages, but Scooby-Doo keeps pushing, I don't know,
yeah.
they don't show anything yet, but they're pushing horror. And Wacky Raceland is definitely for like, I don't know, later, older kids, that's for sure. So
yeah.
Yeah. Don't give them to small children, in other words.
All right, next one's yours.
Next one's mine. Oh, no. Jupiter's Legacy. Everybody's been waiting for this one. Mark Millar, Miller, Fred, Joe, Bonnie, Betty. Frank Quietly did the very first Jupiter's Legacy series over at Image. And since then, it's had like fill-in artists on other series. So... Frank returns for this one. Everybody's been waiting for this one, and so far, so good. Mr. Millar has promised us that this series is almost in the can before its publication sees date, because he took a lot of ribbing over that first series and how miserably long it drug out for us to get the final issues. But he has a good, you know, he's as good as collaboration with artists. If he gets a good artist to share his vision of something, they go there, and you can easily skip the stuff in the middle and just go for the Jupiter's Legacy stuff, I think, with Frank Quietly's art. Because an artist brings to here, like, he can take, like, Millar's B script and give it a level of dimension that it didn't have prior to that, you know? Especially when you're looking at the visuals of a comic book. And fun stuff. He still plays with the formal aspects of setting up scenes. So he's got it down pat. So that was I give it a thumbs up for a try if you're semi-curious about these two.
All right. Yeah. I didn't do the first Jupiter series, so getting into it again was just...
It would be silly, I think, at this point, yes. You'd have to go back to the beginning.
So next up is Weird Detective.
Did you get to read it? Good. Yeah, while there was really nothing horribly original about the concept or the proprieties, as it were, it was kind of done in a manner that kept me going along. The silly running joke kept me going, and the artwork by the guy kept me going. So
yeah.
It was good execution all around on the genre, quote unquote material. I don't know how to phrase it. I saw some John Jones Manhunter in there, which
yeah,
is
and cool. They've also. I mean, it's so I guess they've talked about it, so we're not spoiling anything. But Weird Detective is sort of the new Cthulhu. It's a Lovecraftian. Cthulhu. It's a Lovecraftian thing where the hero is a Lovecraftian monster in some way, and he's trying to protect, or he's from another world where the old gods came back, and he's trying to protect this world from the old gods coming back. Something along those lines. Or not. But, I mean, there's Lovecraft, it's Cthulhu. But he's like a super detective, so it's kind of like Resident Alien. There's nothing original about it. That was kind of the thing.
It fits together well, though.
It fits together pretty well, and I mean, the mystery, we'll see if they do anything with it, but it's kind of weird how supernatural detectives have taken off in the last, I want to say 10 years? Think about Fatal.
How long has Hellblazer been out?
Hellblazer was the only one, though, and Hellblazer didn't exactly sell well enough to convince everybody to do Hellblazer knockoffs.
True.
But, I mean, there's been some other ones in the last couple of years.
Huh. Yeah, I think you're right. Like supernatural noir.
Yeah.
It's definitely an undercurrent.
It's a new genre, yeah, and it's cool to see. You know, I don't really want to read. I've read Fred Valenti's superhero stuff. I don't need to do that anymore.
No. I see him write something that you and I can read.
Right, that's kind of interesting. We got some more of that coming up, I think. But anyway,
comic snobs.
Good art, and this guy's art. The artist's name, crap. Where is it? I swear I had it.
I don't know if I can pronounce it. It's G U I U. How does that pronounce?
Guio. We should just stop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mr. Villanova. Mr. Villanova. We'll just call him Mr. Villanova.
And he's he got his experience in at IDW and Dynamite on licensed properties, and then he ended up at Dark Horse, and this is kind of like Dark Horse that Identity Thief sort of forecast, but then nothing happened with. We haven't started reading more Dark Horse comics, and we thought we were going to, but we really haven't.
No.
I mean, when they lost Star Wars, it seemed like there was a push for them to do more structured stuff, and they didn't really deliver on it.
And I think they also made a push towards media development comics as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, they always were about media development comics. Let's call an egg. But they really, that was a large part of their output. But I don't know, Weird Detective gets a okay rating from me. I think it was fun to read. If you have any sympathies for those Lovecraftian crime noir,
I mean, it's just
undertone of humor.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not.
You know, it's to me, I could compare this with Mr. Spencer, Nick Spencer, over on The Fix.
I know, and that's so much further down. So it's like
I don't want to get into a sub conversation about it. But anyway, these two guys that we're talking about, neither one of us could give a rat's ass about their superhero mainstream stuff. But you know what? When they're allowed to work on what they know how to write a little better, yeah. They're more subservient. They really do some okay comics that you can read.
Yeah, and I mean, when you're doing something like Weird Detective, or you're doing something like The Fix coming up, or a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about, just because your new indie property is ready for a movie or a TV show doesn't mean that we're still at the point that makes it a bad comic. Boom has been around long enough that they can now make good TV shows out of their or good comics out of their pitches, you know. So next up, we're gonna get moving though, because we got a lot. And so next up is Dark Knight 3.
But did you read Dark Knight 3?
No, I told you I wasn't gonna read it.
Oh man, you left that to me, man.
You already read it.
Here, just take that elephant turds and sweep them down the road.
You already read it.
I read it. It's my duty as a dealer. It's really sad shit sometimes, the things I have to do to run a comic book store. But anyway, Frank Miller, Batman, it's about as bad as you could expect it to be, I think. I'm really forcing myself to read it at this point. I don't know if I can last another issue. The artwork is just okay. $6 a hit. You know, you can kind of say that, okay, I'll just buy it because it's Batman, Frank Miller. You know, then they charge you $6 a hit. So I have to give it an eternal I'm done. And we'll move on to the next one. Ooh, I got to keep talking unless you read Dark Heartthrob.
I did. I read all the Heartthrobs.
Well, then, you know, just blow me away with your vivacity.
So Heartthrobs is Christopher Sebelba and somebody else. What's the name
Robert
of this? Robert Wilson the Fourth. And Robert Wilson the Fourth kind of is what makes this book for me. Because he's got that same sort of cartoony style that
Michael Allred.
A little bit like Mike Allred, but not. I was thinking more like the guy who does Train Called Love. Not quite as cartoonish, but
yeah,
certainly
yeah.
animated. And so Heartthrob is it's Fight Club with a girl and a boy. He lives in her head because she got a heart transplant, and it was his heart. And so they get romantically involved, you know, in their brain, in her brain. And then she starts robbing banks because he was a bank robber or something. And I mean, it's like,
he's a master thief, supposedly.
Yeah,
right?
It's, you know, it's enjoyable. It's not. It's like set in 1977, so Sebelba can do, he has pop culture references he can do, you know, and stuff like that. Yeah. So, I mean, it's very appealing. Is it from Oni? It's from Oni, isn't it?
It is from Oni, yes.
It's like Oni. The new Oni of, like, regular, you know, hip, but
might be four and done. I don't know. Have you seen anything past four? I'm not sure.
But, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's all right. It's fine. It's good to read. I mean, like, it's a fun enough read, but you don't want to look at it too much. I don't know. You told me to read it.
Yeah, I thought it was all right. I didn't have any problems with it. It kind of satisfied my need for, I guess, obsessive characters. Sometimes they work really well in comics.
Yeah.
I think that she carries it because I'm not even sure this guy exists, you know.
Right. Yeah, there's still because
yeah. So I'm on board with the layers that are going on here because the story is not in and of itself isn't original, but the narrative seems to carry it through. And you're right, Sebelis. No, this would be Wilson the Fourth artwork. He keeps it like a straight, like dragnet type of look at it all the way through. And so if this thing continues to like 4 or 5, I think I'm going to – I'm enjoying it so far, and I can get to like 4 or 5. I don't think this could be an ongoing, but if he wraps this story up tight enough, I easily recommend it as a read because the character and the texturalism of the weirdness of the character, they're kind of psychotic, obviously, but they put together some really grand plans for robbing banks and stuff like that. So it works as kind of a noir, psychotic – I mean, I could see it being a black and white movie picture in the 50s or something like that. Maybe not necessarily. Maybe the tonality doesn't quite fully convince you. Like if it was a black and white 1955 thriller, you could see, oh, yeah, this broad's crazy, man.
But, yeah, and I mean, it's just – it's also interesting just to see crime comics, this sort of genre of crime comics that – wasn't around 10 years ago. This owes it all to Brubaker and Phillips.
Yep, that's true. Well, Heartthrob is definitely in the noir crime comics canon. And how it finishes its first arc, well, obviously, you know, that happens to almost everything we start reading, you know, and what, 90% of them don't quite bake the cake, as it were. But anyway, we're going to move over to Strange Attractors. Did you get any of that?
No.
I've been coached that his name is actually Charles Soule. Were you the one that did that or
nope.
Someone else did? I don't know.
Somebody else must have.
They heard him on a podcast, and his name is Charles Soule.
That's Soleil. That's
Soleil, sorry. You know, we're determined, Andrew and I are determined doggedly to mangle every single creator's names on this broadcast. But anyway, Strange Attractors, it's an earlier work by Soule, who's on Letter 44, who's done some nice work at DC, including Swamp Thing. And Marvel. Now is working as a Marvel horror, I think it is now.
He did that, the She-Hulk reboot that failed.
Yes, that's true. He did get to do that. That's a nice feather in his cap. We love that. Andrew and I obsessively read that. Strange Attractors is an earlier book. I understand this is being reprinted in big hunks by Boom. And they give you a pretty good bang for your buck for $3.99. You get like 40 pages or whatever, first issue. And the basic plot is a couple of serious kind of scientist-level people utilize chaos math to try to save New York City in a way. And he's dangled quite a few threads and worms in front of us to dangle us for the plot. But it was kind of nicely executed. A lot of it's due to the artist, Greg Scott.
Greg Scott. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what have you heard? What do you know him from?
Dude, Greg Scott's been around. Greg Scott was like the Michael Lark that he was like.
His artwork is just superb. I mean, that's so, you know, got this guy to illustrate this fucking thing is just like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yes, he started, he did Sam and Twitch Case Files. He did,
oh man, those early Sam and Twitches tickle my balls.
He did, where's some more? He filled in on Gotham Central. He did Exile over at, Boom, when Boom was just starting.
Wow.
Yeah, he did.
Why isn't he working in the big leagues?
You know, I have no idea. It looks like he's only ever done minimal stuff with Marvel and DC.
Maybe he just grew up too late for Vertigo, because I cannot imagine him not working at Vertigo on
Zoom.
Yeah. Wow. Well, anyway, Strange Attractors, to get back on track, the execution's great. The reprints, I'm sure they've monkeyed with them, and the creators have done whatever they thought they needed to do to give a better presentation. And it's kind of a nice book. If you're into world disaster-type stories, these two carry it off, and they carry it with you, and you're really attracted to the characters and what they're into. So thumbs up for that one. I got to find another analogy besides thumbs up. Which we do. I don't know. If you come up with another one, let me know by the end of the month. All right, we're going to move on to one of Andrew's recent favorite, The Spider.
The Spider finishes up, and it is awesome.
Awesome.
This is a book that sort of just came out of nowhere. I mean, like, you know, what was it? Six Gun Gorilla was good, but it had its problems. We did not expect that. Reading The Spire was sort of frustrating, because every issue you're like, is this where they're going to fuck it up? Is this where, not Stokely, but Simon Spurrier. Is this where Spurrier is going to fuck it up? Because Spurrier fucks it up. He does. He does. You know, like, we read his books, not religiously. I don't read all of his books, but... You know, he'll do something good, and you'll be really impressed, and then he'll fuck it up. And the Spire, he doesn't fuck it up, ever. It's just great.
Well, you know, like, it's hard to dispose of Six Gun Gorilla. I still sell those trades in my shop to people who haven't had the indie experience. And I, like, you know, it's something I shove in their direction. I go, here, you want to read a really fucking good comic book that'll make you give up superheroes? Read Six Gun Gorilla. After this... My son, you will no longer look at superheroes in the way same way you did before. Well, those two getting back together on The Spire, you know, it made our noses like, hey, we got to read this, man. Mm-hmm. These guys did some good shit. We'll just put this on the radar here.
So, yeah, and it actually got him a lot of good notice, I feel like. More than Six Gun Gorilla did, even though I don't know that it sold better.
Well,
it's a boom. Who knows how those?
Not significant numbers, unless they sold it for property's sake or something. No,
The Spire's got a trade coming out in December, so that'll be nice.
That's a double thumb, little pinky, big left testicle thumbs up for, man. I mean, get that trade if you like to read indie comics and you want to read good series.
Just imagine getting to read it all, because okay, so we've talked about it at length, but I mean.
Yes.
The really cool thing about how Spurrier finishes it up is he's got a lot of information. It's an 8-issue series, and the conclusion has a lot to do with previous information. And he just is really good at pacing out the story. Like, I think it's going to read really well in a trade.
Oh.
Because, man. Like, you know, the last, yeah. It's just, yeah. So, anyway.
Slap people in the head with this book when they come to my door.
The Spire. And it's very accessible stuff. That's the thing about Six Gun Guerrilla was it was very accessible indie stuff that was going on now. Spire's the same way. It's just better. And it's just, I mean, I don't know. It's our second Boom book. We're having that period where we read a lot of Boom and we don't even realize it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll read anybody, anywhere, anytime, as long as it's good. That's my motto.
All right. So now, next up, there's this little book called Six Gun... No. I was going to say Six Gun Guerrilla. Sixth Gun. There's this book called Sixth Gun, and it just finished.
Well, you know...
And... You know, I have not read it for...
Yeah, you haven't read it. Now, how far do you have to go?
Okay, here we go. I have not looked. This and Unwritten, I have not looked. I need to start reading Sixth Gun from issue 24. The series.
Maybe I should say something quick and leave it at that so I don't spoil it for you. But I think that Sixth Gun finished. It published its last issue recently, a couple weeks back. Big, huge, hunking fucking comic. I think it was $7 or $8. And it kind of finished the way it needed to finish. I wasn't surprised, but the two creators managed to do what this big, long, overwhelming epic kind of had to do at the end, I guess. You know? And it's interesting in a way why it ended the way it did. I'm looking forward to the creators... hopefully someday learning about why they made the aesthetic decisions they did. But overall, The Sixth Gun was an emotional, nice, lyrical, mythological read that fans of the darker genre will like and appreciate, I think. Yeah, yeah. So I give it okay. I mean, it finishes nice. And when you catch up, then we're on board on that one. Anyway, you know, one thing, the next title that's been making the rounds, Kaiju Max by our buddy Xander Canyon. You know, you're right. Like in your last review online, you talked about how really dark the series is getting. I mean, it's dark anyway, but, you know, it's been getting into the seriously dark. Like, you hope these guys have, like, a 911 number they can call.
Yeah, I mean, so...
You know, we're assuming our customer base here knows what we're talking about.
Yeah, so yeah. Kaiju Max Series 2, Season 2, they're just calling it Season 2. Yeah, you thought it was dark when it was in jail dealing with these kaiju convicts, but it's worse when they're ex-cons.
Yeah.
And it's worse when they escape and Cannon, you know, he looks at the just fucked up world situation. It's just awful. Yeah. Like, it's
nihilists need not apply to
right.
This.
Like, it's very.
It's with
there's definite metaphor to, you know, actual. You know, social issues, but.
Yeah.
Then he just takes it, like, further and makes it worse. Like, oh, yeah, you're the last two robots in the world, and we blew your head off or something. You know, like, it's just he takes the level of detail. He takes... Kaiju Max is more a miserable comic about...
Is that what Japanese people are like? Are they really miserable?
I don't know. I mean, it's just very weird because he doesn't go with the... He wants to instead do a miserable Ultraman more
right.
than he wants to do the social ramifications of that. Like, he really deep down just wants to punish Kaiju.
I'm sure it's just tough. Did you read the latest issue?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. It kind of semi-redeems itself here, I guess. I mean, it, if you're going to crank it back two notches or something, you can say it's on a positive note here. It's about...
Wait a second. Did I read the latest issue? What are you talking about?
Grandma.
Hold on.
Latest issue you sent me... Did I? No, you didn't... I sent it to you. Maybe you didn't get to read it. I'm not sure.
Vernon's bragging to everyone about how he's reading something a month early, just so everybody knows.
Well, I'm a retailer. I get PDFs.
You do get PDS, but you already ordered all your Kaiju Max 3, so you knew what you needed. You just wanted to read ahead.
Yes, this is correct.
Because it's a good book. All right, so I'm looking forward to that. All right, so on the second issue, oh, man, it's just so rough. Like, oh, it deals with, like, you know, the analog to racism. And just, like, just really uncomfortable stuff where it's, like, you know, you don't find out that the guy's not a racist. You find out that he is.
Yeah.
And he's just making it work. You know, it's just awful. And then it gets even, I mean, it's just, and then, ugh.
You know, it's tough stuff all around. And, you like I said, you know, I read your last review on Kaiju Max, and like, it's relentlessly dark. And I go, yeah, it is right now. You really don't want to be suicidal and read Kaiju Max right now.
I just don't know.
I can laugh through this because it's really good. So, I mean, I'm not.
My only concern about it is I don't know where he can eventually take it. There's.
You know, it's true. But what do we got? We got 10 or 12 under our belts, maybe 10. And he's got to come up with something. I mean, he's got so much energy here. You're right. Like, where does he take this? This is.
You know, because, like, the first series isn't resolved yet.
But
and
you
it's
never
just...
read the issue after this, right?
Okay. No.
Okay. Not that it redeems the series or, like, I say it dials it back two notches, okay? And what's really nice is it's done in one. Hoo-ha.
Okay.
You know, and that, you know, I'm going to sit there and pray at the altar of Xander Canyon because he does it done in one. I mean, that is like a dying art form. Dinosaur in our industry, you know. Oh, Kevin forbid you just pick up one comic of a comic series and read it, enjoy it, and not be punished because you don't want to buy six fucking.
I mean,
more.
All right, let's go on this tangent because I'm just thinking about it. It's not so much that you can't, you have to pick up all six. It's not that you have to, like, pick up, you know, 12 through 18. It's that you, if you got 12 and 13,
yeah,
but you missed 14, it was still okay just to get 15.
There's enough plot in these things.
Right,
to show
there's people. Enough that you get a pass, and there's enough exposition, there's thought balloons, and there's exposition boxes, and there's enough to, like, get you through. So it's not where you're fixated more on the comic as a possession than you are on it as, you know, this narrative you're following. Like, you know, it's a soap opera. Like, you need to be able to miss a soap opera. You have
yeah.
to.
Yeah, it's Japanese movie Dinosaurs and Oz, essentially. But, you know, it's really dense because it takes you 15 minutes to read this thing. You know, I can read Green Lanterns in 5, okay? Kaiju Max takes me 15 minutes easily.
It's just,
and then
just
I'll
so much,
again.
Yeah.
You know,
just...
I missed shit the first time around, you know? Unbelievable. Anyway,
yeah.
Get your butts in gear. If you haven't read Kaiju Max, first trade available, $10. I'm going to slap you senseless if you don't buy it. All right, onward. Ah, shit, I got to talk some more.
You got to talk? I don't even know what
this
is.
Let me grab a swig of beer while you tell this next title here. Introduce me.
All right, so Vernon's going to talk about a comic called The Starve or Starve, which he never convinced me well enough that I should read it, and I think it's done now, so...
It's the writer. You're just prejudiced against the
Who
writer.
Who is it? Oh, shit. Is it? Oh, I can't wait. Oh, I can't wait. Oh, shit. Is it Rick Remender?
No, thank God it's not.
Right.
Oh, no. It's Who Brian it? Wood. It's Brian Wood. Hey, you know what? Brian Wood does have a good idea. Like, I've
Brian
read a lot.
Wood always has a good idea. He just doesn't have it for more than half of an issue.
Anyway, he's got 10. He's got 10 on Starve. And he manages to put in a disciplined effort here where he gets 10 issues to tell the story. Does fine. He gets, okay, here we go. Dengil Zezelez.
That's right. That's why I actually should have read this, is because that guy's fucking great. All right.
And two pair. Like, see, when you would talk about a visual artist carrying the writer's vision through to the next level, he does. Starve is going to be two trades, volume one and volume two. And, you know, Starve is a big, massive corporate social conscious type of thing that Brian Wood's exercising out of his system is a foodie here, where the main character is a washed out chef who had it all and lost it all, and who has dreams for his daughter not being swallowed by the machine, as it were. And you know what? For 10 issues, it works fine. And I'm not going to say 50% of his Zezel's Visions.
I'm going to read this thing. Oh, no, you're such a jerk.
Barf on me, okay? I think it's all right stuff. I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, it's the best of the year, man.
Well, no, I forgot. I should have been reading it. I forgot about Dan and Dill Zed.
Well, you know what? You're going to blow through these, but I'm going to suggest that if you blow through these, that just make sure you look at the visuals, because they're just beautiful.
What do I love that guy from?
Lots of DC shit. I remember he finished off Warren Ellis's Desperation Jones. That's his biggest
achievement. That's his biggest thing, but that's not one I know him from.
He did a Vertigo, what about the crippled Western fighter? Spanish.
Okay, the first time I saw him was Congo Freaking Bill.
Yes.
Which was the relaunch of Congorilla.
Yes.
Which was not, as I recall, a good comic, but it was awesome. It had awesome art.
It's just written. The guy looks like he's using stencils, and yet they're so artfully composed. And he's got such a exotic sensibility about how he handles panels and figures and compositions. It's really a treat to the eye.
Yeah. The Eastern European art movement never really picked up the way, you know, I would have wanted it to. Those guys did a lot of really interesting stuff.
They really do. Like, Eastern European artists are held at bay by Eastern European writers who aren't really that good.
Right. Good point. Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on. Anyway,
let's move on to something that I can gush over, and Vernon can point to all the times that I shit-mouth the writer, because I used to do that. And I probably would if I still read any other Greg Rucka. But Lazarus, everyone. Lazarus is back for another issue where we find out a little bit more about Forever's family. There's some good action scenes in it. I like that Lazarus is finally delivering regular Michael Lark action scenes.
Oh, Forever's last battle was gorgeous.
It's just like, it's Michael Lark action scenes on a regular basis. Like, I feel like when the series started, they were still, like, holding back a little, where it would take a while to get the great Michael Lark action scene that, you know, he hated doing. I mean, that's, like, the thing is, you know, he just fucking hates it. You know, like, they're just like, hey, I sent you over some Captain America action figures to pose if you want to do this. Because he did a whole, like, he did the whole intro to that Marvel summer event where Asgard crashes to Earth.
Right.
And so it's like a Michael Lark Marvel fight issue zero for a crossover. You just know he hated it. He just hated it.
Yeah. I know. He loves doing this stuff, man.
He does. And Lazarus is just, it's just,
I feel my diaper looking at Michael Lark. It's just so good, man. I mean, yeah, I'm just blowing my mind on his dynamic visuals, the fight scenes. You know, it doesn't get better. These two season pros are at their peak of their creativity.
I know. And I mean, Rucka's just got it down now. He's just.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it in a bit because we're going to talk about some TV stuff. But when you read Lazarus, it is very much Rucka's attempt at doing a. He's attempting to do a smaller scale dystopian Game of Thrones type thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it. It doesn't make the first arc of it okay. It still has all of its problems. But had I understood that I just had to wait it out, maybe...
Lazarus was an organic vehicle, like we've used the phrase. It got better as it got old.
It did, but I mean, it took it aside. I mean, the first arc was really bad soap opera shit. Like...
But you know what? I mean, these guys were thinking mainstream that.
That's true. Yeah, I guess. Maybe they were responding.
Cut that shit up, and we did too.
All right, so next up is Department H, which you read, I guess.
Department H. You know what? Who is it? Matt Kent. He did that, like, spy thing for Dark Horse. He still got his stuff printed in Dark Horse. This is a mini-series of... I don't know, half a dozen plus issues maybe. Good dark suspense. I mean, it's fully convincing. If Kim has one thing working for him here, is that his, what do you call him? What's that? Shit. expressionistic artwork, okay, with figures and environment and atmosphere seems to work here, all right? And he's so far ahead of indie wannabe people that you say, okay, the guy got it down pat. So three issues into this mystery story involving a daughter trying to solve the mystery of her father, comes across as, I don't know, genre-type material, but Kent blows it on. He works, and you're sucked into it, and it's fully convincing. So I was like, okay, I'm still on board with this. If there's one thing that does drive me nuts, this is lettering. It's too small. I have to go get my reading glasses. When you're publishing a comic book, okay, you should never, ever make someone go get their reading glasses to read your comic book, speaking as a older individual. But Kent otherwise is fully infectious and convincing in this story. I don't know. If you like good dark underwater sea mystery stuff, I guess, is that a genre? I don't know. Maybe it isn't. I don't know. Yeah, Andrew's giving me the FU here.
Yeah, okay, so everybody is going to hear why you get the FU here.
Just go for it. Okay, good. Go for it.
Many a year ago, Matt Kent worked on a book called Pistol Whip with Jason Hall, and I love that book, and Vernon shit all over it.
I hated that book.
And then I get Super Spy, which is Kent's next big thing, and I fucking hate it. And Vernon's just like, I told you that guy blew. Fast forward 10 years, and now Vernon's like, oh yeah, Matt Kent. I can't wait for the new Matt Kent book to come out.
You know what? I'm not saying, like, sometimes he fails miserably, man. And this time he's not failing, okay? But we'll see how it ends, okay? But, you know, he's got that.
Mr. Whip is a good comic. It's a good comic.
Yeah. What was it? What was that spy one? I read many issues of that, and it was all right, too.
Did not read Super Spy.
No, not Super Spy. It's the one he did later for Dark Horse. Crap.
Hold on. I've got it up. Mind Management.
Mind Management. Read some Mind Management. That one I enjoyed quite a few. I saw a few of those ones. I couldn't read them all. I didn't have time. But, you know, we're just going to thrust swords at each other here.
Read my Matt Kent. Can't believe you're pre-ordering this Matt Kent book. It's like, Vernon, I don't want to take your money for that. I bought Super Spy from you.
Well, you know what? Department H is okay.
It's not decent.
Anyway, what's after Department H?
The Fix. All right. Steve Lieber does the art on this book, and it's people who don't know, Steve Lieber, did he ever work on Gotham Central regular?
Yeah, I bet he did.
But late, but not early, late. So Steve Lieber got his start with Greg Rucka at Oni, old days Oni, doing Whiteout. It was a big deal. Vern and I actually saw him at a Comic-Con once.
We did.
I bought that Swamp Thing lithograph, the black and white from him. So we saw Steve Lieber, 12 years ago. So Steve Lieber, Greg Rucka got a lot of jobs. Lieber got some jobs, but he never got, it's not like Steve Lieber can do Wonder Woman, right?
Steve Lieber has the Michael Larkism thing going.
If Michael Lark, Steve Lieber, and Sean Phillips did something together, the universe would explode. It would just be the end of time, right?
That's right. The heavens would close, and we'd be all stuck here on hell.
We would never have so much restrained enthusiasm in a realistically drawn comic book ever. It's like, these are all guys that, to some degree, you want to see what they do with range. So The Fix is a...
It's a noir.
It's a noir. It's a modern neo-noir. It's a comics noir.
It's a comedy.
It's a comic noir. And comic noir has gotten to be its own thing at this point.
They're pushing the boundaries there.
Yeah. So, it's fun. It's dirty cops.
Dirty, stupid cops. Don't forget the stupid word.
Dirty, stupid. Yeah.
stupid. I'm like, these cops, I go, what's my selling point for this? If you want to read a funny comic about two stupid, dirty cops, this is a good one. And a lot of people come, the ones that are into it, come back for more.
Yeah. And it's Nick Spencer who...
Suspect Deluxe. You know, he did one thing I enjoyed, The Amazing Foes of Spider-Man recently at Marvel with Steve Lieber, coincidentally enough here. So both of those two tried to get this title going. Didn't happen. Or it happened long enough. Probably went 10 or 12 issues, I think.
You know what we read by Nick Spencer?
Oh, I remember what I tried to read by Nick Spencer, that god-awful Morning Glories. Oh, my God, I think I'm going to...
I never read that. It was...
never read this. Pray on God's help. You never read that.
It was Thunder Agents. Remember that?
You know, that was good.
That was good, and then DC fucked it up with one of the relaunches, and it never came back. It was supposed to come back as a new 52 book, and it never did or something.
So he can write. This is interesting. There is a Nick Spencer.
Morning Glories.
Oh, that is so god awful.
I just remember that we never could motivate ourselves to read it.
Well, you know, I tried to read it. It was just like, God made me want to go to the closet and beat my putt or something. I don't know. This is bad.
That was before the Image sort of...
Whatever. Like, we can't present these comics because they really suck.
Image hadn't blossomed yet. It was pre-profit Image. And, you know, there were some diamonds in the rough, but not a lot.
We got to finish up on The Fix here, don't we?
Okay. Yeah.
So what do we got to say about The Fix? What do you think about The Fix?
It's fine. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it's professional run-in with... The two stupid cops in there.
Anytime the writing pisses you off too much, you get to look at Steve Lieber doing, you know, a fucking sunny Florida noir comic. Like,
right.
His lines are different. His lines are a lot fuller here, too.
Did you see the cover for Three? Did I show it? It's a great one. I mean... It just picks you up and runs with you, and it's a fine light comic. And if you're into this genre, you know, just skip the superhero stuff and read this thing, basically.
Right.
It's so much more fun than Green Lantern. I can't describe it. All right, what do we get next? Oh, my, it's another Vern show. Da, 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 da. Satellite Falling. Did you read these at all?
No. You didn't tell me to.
I may have. You know, like, you're not really into genre science fiction per se. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe you are. I don't know. But two issues out from IDW, of all places. IDW. And Mike Horton. You know, Steve Horton, thank you. I don't know where all these all blasts from the past guys are actually putting together comics I can read or not. Who do we say? What was the Copperhead? That was the other two.
Oh, my God, yes. I was just thinking about Copperhead because there hasn't been one in a while. It's fucking... Faber. Jay fucking Faber. Anyway, everybody go read Copperhead. It's in trade, and it's on hiatus right now, but it's good. But Vernon's going to keep talking about this.
There's another one. He's another one that I read a couple of his books, and he really didn't do anything for me. But he got Stephen Thompson on the artwork. And this is another nicely produced comic about an agent who drives a cab who's got a mission or whatever it is, a life mission or whatever. I'm not quite sure yet, but she's a cabbie on a controlled environment where all these different types of alien live. It's called Satellite Falling. And again, it's a fully realized, nicely done, fully convincing comic. I mean, these guys really work hard to tell the story, establish the characters, keep the plot moving, and provide enough depth and texture and detail to make it worth $3.99. I swear, if you're into this genre at all, really, just look for this comic. And it's got two issues out. Buy them both. They're both really high-octane, very fast adventure things. And yet they got the noir thing going on, too. You could easily see this is transferring to a movie or TV or whatever, but it's really high quality. So I'm going to let that one go. All right, next. On the last show, we didn't talk about Sabrina and Archie releasing a new issue to that afterwards.
Hold on, let me look.
Look.
I'm going to look.
I'll get another beer.
I was just impressed that you liked an IDW book.
You know, what are they, like 95% licensed tie-ins? We got to find IDW. It's supposed to be Idea Design Works. What can we call it again? I don't know, maybe by our next podcast I'll have a new
name
for it.
Is it a month since we did one? Yeah, no, we did Sabrina and Archie. All right, we don't need
to. Okay, anyway, well, read those. Those came out with the new issue. Read those. Okay, but did you read Circuit Breaker by Mr. B?
Yeah,
okay, gosh, well, one of our favorites, Kyle Baker, is doing this book called Circuit Breaker. It's kind of a dark homage to Astro Boy and the whole Japanese anime genre. And it succeeds on so many levels. Purists will be hard-pressed to really enjoy his iPad renderings of a comic book at some points. That I miss his line work. It's done because he can do it on the computer, and I dig it and all that. I wish it were just a niche higher as far as the visual quality were concerned. But that notwithstanding, it's a pretty good book. The main character is really strong, kind of has the Astro Boy identity, and under Kyle Baker's hand. And who's the writer on this? Let me look this up real quick.
Hold on, I have the floppies that you sent me and I didn't read because I'm...
Oh man, let me spank your bottom, boy.
Who the hell are they?
Kevin McCarthy. Yeah, this is a really dark, bleak version of the future presented with persecution of robots and one girl robot and her desperate struggle to maintain her identity and balance her emotions and pick the right side in this upcoming battle between humans and what is left of robots. And it's pretty dark stuff. I think it's like 5 issues running. It's a miniseries or something, but it's through Image. And it's really gotten, like, I think it's doing like 5,000 copies per issue, so I don't even know how many of you can access a copy through your local dealer. Maybe none. I don't know. I'll get it at my shop, though. Get your ass up. Kyle Baker's an easy one. I will read Kyle Baker's, I don't know, menu notes if I have to, because he is just that good. Anyway, look for that one. That is solid stuff. Please do. Please do. All right, this one I didn't read, but I think you did.
You haven't read I Hate Fairyland 6?
No, I haven't. God bless me.
So Fairyland has been I would actually put it on the level of Kaiju Max with unexpected sort of successes from established creators. You know, I mean, Xander Cannon, you know, he did Top 10, he did S-Max, he did Top... But it's not like anybody's talking about how Top 10 Series 2 was Secret Genius, you know, like... Same thing kind of goes for Scotty Young, you know, we've all known he does great. Sort of dark, but he's like kind of a Marvel Tim Burton, you know, like...
Yeah, this one page of her holding the axe is just gorgeous.
Yeah, and so, you know, I Hate Fairyland sort of came along out of nowhere. I don't even remember if you told me to read it or if I was just like, I'm going to read a Scotty Young book. Yeah, I mean, it's just this weird, mean fairy tale thing. I mean...
It's dark.
It's really dark and just gross and unpleasant.
But it's got not a Hanna-Barbera, but perhaps some type of Cartoon Factory look to it.
Like if it were a generic Disney, you know, like if it were like that knockoff sequel, a Filmation. It's like a Filmation Fairyland. So yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and it's just one of those books that, it's kind of weird in the same way Kaiju Max is that if you were trying to recommend something to somebody outside of comics, it would be one of the more accessible things.
It's super mainstream looking, that's for sure. Everybody on this book knows what the hell they're doing. I think it was Paul Mounce is on coloring. And Oh, let's see. No, this is Jean-Francois Boulot, if I'm not mangling this gentleman's name, which I probably fucking am. But anyway, he does a great job on the colors. The whole thing looks like a super professional package. There's no way.
And I mean, it's just a cool book. It came back after, you haven't read it, but I'll just say that there's an interesting narrative decisions. Yeah.
Ooh, ooh. I'll have to bring the first trade home. I was gonna
it's not in the first trade. It's in the second trade.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah.
Missed that one. Shit. Yeah.
All right. So all moving on to, I guess interesting.
We're finishing off with this.
We're finishing up the floppies, but we're finishing it up with...
Cinema Purgatorio.
Issue 2.
Two, particularly.
Did we not talk about one? No, we didn't, because you hadn't read it yet.
It just came out.
So Cinema Purgatorio, a comics Kickstarter that I funded to the point of getting an early fucking copy of the first issue.
It is worth millions.
Because I wanted to do my part for Alan Moore and Garth Ennis doing good horror comics at Avatar.
He still is the best writer on this title.
Who, Garth Ennis or Alan Moore?
Moore.
Well, but...
Short story, right?
Yeah, except it's Alan Moore kind of fucking with you. That's kind of what the subtitle of this episode is, everybody. It's the they're fucking with you episode. Like, it's Alan Moore doing movie stuff. It's Alan Moore being like, no, I know how to do movies. I could have done Watchmen and it would have been great. It's very weird. It feels like Top 10. Even though it's totally different, it feels like Top 10 in that, like, holy shit, hey guys, yeah, I just did the best, like, sci-fi cop show ever, and, you know, I'm Alan Moore. Like, you know, my wife's drawing a story about Peter Pan, you know.
Yeah. Well, two Cinema Purgatorio chapters are really dark.
And they're just these dark, it's just, but I mean, there's even that. It's about, like, how going to the movies sucks your life away. Like, and how, like, your life only exists in the span of the movie that you're, I mean, it's him just saying fuck you to movies. Like, and that's kind of, you know, we want that. You know, like, we want to see Alan Moore say that. Like, yeah.
It's just amazing. Within 8 or 10 pages, he just sets up this thing and it all up.
And all I can wonder is did he tell Kevin O'Neill, he's like, so I need you to do this. It's not going to be a lot of work. Because I've never seen less detailed Kevin O'Neill art in my life.
Well, what is Kevin O'Neill getting paid to work for?
Hey, well, that's what I'm saying. I'm like, Kevin, can you do this? You know? I swear to God, we're going to sell League of Extraordinary Gentlemen to Steven Spielberg someday. And, you know, you're never going to have to work again.
They're pretty dark little bits.
They are. And I mean, it's in their topical. The one with the Roman guys. It's like Hail Caesar.
Yeah.
It's fucked up. It has
the emotive resonance of his other works in a way, because it really jars you out of your reality. The Watch, it's really fucking surreal, man. I mean, I didn't even know about the film reference. A customer later told me about that, and I didn't even know that, and it still jarred me out of the whole thing.
It's Alan Moore. He's like kind of showing off, you know, and that's cool.
Showing off.
And the only issue with that is that how much was the second issue?
Oh, I think they're about, $6 a hit? Yeah.
Right, so you just paid $6 for a really great Alan Moore, you know.
All right, $3. Okay, so $3 is Alan Moore.
Yeah, and then the rest of it, they're giving, you know, 50 cents to everybody else because it's big Avatar names doing terrible work.
It is short stories. It still has a resonance, but, you know, it's going to lose that fast unless you're right. They don't adopt to the short story method.
I mean, so you've got – all right. We're just going to talk about this because you've got Garth Ennis doing Code Crew.
Yes.
Which was a good two-parter that Ennis did for Avatar. It was weird. Right. It was funny. It was hip.
Two full-length comics.
Two full-length comics. It was Garth Ennis doing A Train Called Love, but with girl drama and witchcraft. It was kind of, it could have been awesome, right?
Right. It could have been acceptable to the next level, too. It could have achieved that next level.
It could have been Garth Ennis actually doing something with horror comics, right? Like, I mean, on a level of importance as Crossed. He could have gone far with this. This was, you know, going to be Sex in the City by Garth Ennis with witches. It was going to be great. Then Prue becomes a paramedic who helps monsters.
Yeah,
like, Frankenstein's monster. And, I mean, it's just like these limp, four-page stories. I mean, it's
filled with social content, mind you.
Well, yeah, but no, there's just this hinted social content. You're just like, oh, God, he's drinking too much. Like, something's happened to Garth. Like, it's platitudes and like, oh, yeah. So,
still, I'm such a whore. But I'm not going to say I like these things all that much, but it's still a good 7-page fucking story.
It's not, though. You know what that comic should be. It would read like a Marvel horror comic in this back up in the 70s. It would be fine. And Garth Ennis can't do that.
No, he's got to bring in the other stuff.
It's like he doesn't have, I mean, this is not, Garth Ennis is not good at doing 7-page stories. I mean, like, that shouldn't be a surprise to us.
No, it really shouldn't, because he can't get something said in 7 pages.
He pioneered, the preacher trades were, you needed to read those in trades. That was, great way to read that comic. And he needed that much room. He needed what? Then five issues with Punisher. And like, we were apprehensive of him doing war stories in 3 issues.
Oh, yeah.
When he had 4 issues of story, he knew what to do with it. So having 7 pages of story, he just has no fucking clue.
Right. It's a too tight of an arrangement.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, what's this going to read like?
Like a size 9 and a size 6 shoe. He just can't do it. Anyway, but this anthology, it's not, I swear to God, we got problems with this thing, okay? And you're right. I think the biggest problem is they don't know how to write for the short story format. And
I think the other guys are cutting up comics. I think they're cutting up full issues.
Well, that's the problem. This would read nice. You didn't have to read it in sections or something like that. Because on their own, they're not too bad. You know, you could
get some good art. There's some really good art on them.
Yes, there's some nice art. There's some okay concepts. The post-apocalyptic Mad Max Pokemon is okay, and the weird Civil War thingy. I mean, we'll see what happens. But
it's like, I don't care. I'm not going to care.
Get to the point. We want
to
know.
Are they zombies or vampires? Just tell me.
Yeah, don't show me the claw and leave me hanging for the next issue. That's silly. And I don't know. In the vast, you're right. I liked one of your comments on one of your things. Like, it spends a lot of time describing things that it's not showing. There's nothing for the artist to do here. And this
The vast. That's the Pacific Rim meets Edge of Tomorrow sci-fi crap. That was the one that they added at the last minute.
Right, or something, because it doesn't need to be crammed in here. I'd like more thing. Yeah, and I'm like, ugh. So and for all this magazine's failings, and I'm utterly surprised by this, it is still 10 times better than Grant Morrison's Heavy Metal magazine. It is such tragic stuff. But anyway, Cinema Purgatorio is still worth your copper if you have patience and like genre science fiction fantasy.
And if you want to think about it's definitely worth your copper and your time. But especially copper, because it's not cheap. If you want to think about, as you're reading Alan Moore's more successful overall projects right now, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's got his book coming out soon, his novel, he's got all sorts of stuff going on, and you want a fuller picture of what he's doing.
I was thinking when I started reading these Cinema Purgatorio stories, is there's only two of them. And I'm like, God, wouldn't it be cool if Fantagraphics did one of those from beginning of life to death reprint of Alan Moore stories from the beginning of when he started publishing and putting them in chronological order? And wouldn't that be madness to read that? And you'd be on this book to the seven hells or something like that. I don't know, but it would be a wild train ride, just at least.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just, it's, you know, you're just, comics is a thing, is a medium where there are still true masters of the art, you know, like we lose them in other mediums, but with comics, you know, you've still got Alan Moore around. Alan Moore didn't ever, you know, fuck up. Like, he really didn't.
Even
he worked for Rob Liefeld and he survived everyone. Like,
he was already a king slayer when he was
right.
Working for Rob Liefeld.
Like, he, you know, he did it. You know, like, he managed never to be, you know.
He's never boring. He's, you know, they always give Alan Moore shit because he's a genre writer. I go, you know, that may be true in some ways, but he understands it and he successfully translates it and he picks the right artist to illustrate it. So what's your problem here? What is your problem?
Right. And it's like,
as good as is, maybe if you can, I'll listen to your argument, but otherwise fuck off.
It's just interesting to see Ennis. And I guess if Ennis were at this point in his career, 10 years, like where Moore was 10 years ago, I'd feel better about Ennis. But I feel like, I don't know if he's going to weather as well as Moore did in the end.
Hard to say. He seems older, but you don't really know. What are their ages?
All right. Well, I was just thinking about when their careers started.
Yeah. They were both, I think Moore's older.
But yeah. Sure. So Moore's 62.
Yeah.
Ennis is only 46.
Holy fuckaroni.
I can't believe it. He's a young buck. He's got, all right.
Young fuck.
I gotta leave him alone about this shit. He's got 15 years.
No shit.
He's got 15 years to get to the fucking feature now. All right.
Yeah, he won't even be getting old until Alan Moore's dead.
All right. So what we're saying is that some of Garth Ennis's fuck ups could be, you know, we could look at them like, you know, supreme, you know, like just, you know.
Work for hire.
It was just his time in the rough time. All right, so you're going to talk about some trades.
Well, I was going to talk about, I was going to check in with DC Rebirth, too.
You are?
Just really quickly.
All right, I'm ready for it.
No, like you give a shit about
that. Hold on. I read two of them, or one of them?
Holy fuckaroni, you did?
I read Detective Comics because it was getting a lot of good press. And I read, No, so I read Detective Comics, and then I decided I was done reading DC Rebirth. And I don't even have a problem with it.
No, I'm not gonna put lipstick on a pig or anything.
I mean, it seems like it's better than,
Right, it's a more structured product. Like, you and I have talked about this before, and in some ways, DC has been able to have like a set of – they've established a skeletal structure to their product that they didn't have, especially when you look at his product from the DC 52 universe. And one can hope – I'm not sure with this advanced schedule they're promoting the books at, that's going to be very difficult because they got to produce two books a month on their headliners. And that is a schedule I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy some days, you know. So you really got to plan ahead and you really got to get that product out. And we'll see if this experiment of theirs works. We'll see. But overall, they get an acceptability. There's a code of acceptability, okay? I don't have a problem with the titles. There's Batman number one that has this ridiculous airplane thing with Batman, and it kind of reminds you of a Bruce Willis movie. And it's totally silly and over the top, illustrated by whatever his name is. He makes it happen. And that's fine. The ending blows. It is what it is my review of the ending of that one. It's blown away because on the variant cover, they got two other characters that have.
Yeah.
And, you know, why are we introducing more Batman characters? Jesus fucking Christ. We don't have enough Batman characters already. We've got to bring two more in.
No, I'm gonna guess it's because they want. I've only read one of these, so I'm just talking out of my ass, but.
Yes, you are, but that's okay. It's your podcast.
Gotham is on TV. It's hanging out. It's a lot of characters. It's the Game of Thrones with Gotham City.
Right.
I think they want to add as many characters to Batman as they can because that's how they want. That's how they see selling that many books. You are logging, you're checking in to see what's going on with Red Robin across titles versus Batman chasing Joker across titles.
Yes.
And I think that it's, I think that that's good. I think that that's,
I'm just an old tradition.
Okay, so here's the thing. And I hadn't even thought of this until you were talking about it, but for DC readers, it's like the one thing every DC reader could agree on is that when DC relaunched after the first Crisis on Infinite Earths in the 80s, they did a pretty damn good job.
Yeah, that was fine.
I mean, they got some good comics out of it. Like, those George Perez Wonder Womans are really, kind of really good superhero comics.
It proved to them they could publish really good,
right,
genre-driven comics.
You didn't have to do a special, you know, Frank Miller Batman. You didn't have to do a special. It's like the Swamp Thing, the level of sort of seriousness they took with Swamp Thing over at DC and then what would become Vertigo could be applied to other things without going overboard with it. You could still maintain, you know, enthusiasm. You could still have that fucking Starman book. Remember that?
Yeah. There's the key word, enthusiasm. DC needs to build enthusiasm about their line, and that is a tangible. It's tough to achieve.
It's very hard, because everybody talking about how hard DC's had it with Superman and the movies and everything else, you got to think back. They've been dealing with that since 88. They've been dealing with that since before 88. Like, Man of Steel by John Byrne was to brought in Marvel readers to Superman. That was what it was trying to do. Yeah. You know, and it's just like, so I feel like with Rebirth, with New 52, it's just like you want to, you trust that. Part of being a DC reader is trusting them not to fuck it up.
Oh, they won't fuck me in the ass.
And it's like, after New 52, like, they really fucked that up. Like,
they fucked me in the ass.
And I mean, they fucked it up at the start, and they just kept fucking it up over and over again. And it's like, so with Rebirth,
what was the thing? Conference or Conscience or Convergence? San Diego Convergence or something.
I don't know.
It sucked. And it was like, oh my God.
I mean, they just didn't know what the fuck they were doing. Like,
they didn't know.
They were just like, no, we can do Ultimate DC as the whole line. And it'll work because, you know, it worked back in 88. And it's like, when we put George Perez, who was the most popular artist of the 80s, right? They put him on a fucking Wonder Woman comic. Yeah, that was going to do well. Like, it's George Perez. Like,
and it poisoned the well for their future efforts as well. The new DCU or whatever, the line that launched, actually produced a few good titles, but nothing that could catch on in the market. Nothing at all. And it was getting...
There were books we liked. There were New 52 books that we liked that died miserably.
Your favorite. That was great. But yeah, so we were really wondering, and DC Rebirth, so far, first month report, okay, I'm going to do a month report if that's possible, and I'll leave it at that. So far, they get a passing grade. Now, whether they can keep up the production schedule, whether they can keep people's interest in their books, remains to be seen, as far as I'm concerned. That's the pass, as it were. But
is there is there any book that you, what are you still reading?
I will be reading the Hanna-Barbera titles.
That doesn't count. What fucking superhero book that comes out twice a month will you be reading?
I've dropped Green Lantern. And let's see, what else doesn't interest me at all? I probably won't read Aquaman again. And I probably will read Greg Rucka's Wonder Woman.
Okay.
And I may pick up another Batman and Superman. We'll see where they go with their current plot lines. Go ahead.
I'm just the detective. The response to Detective Online has been really positive. And, you know, I read it and I sort of understood what everybody was saying about that. And I'm just like, I got no time for that. But
I
get it. Like,
something vested in the characters.
Well, I mean, and it, you know, yeah, and it's like, this is what DC did really well back in 80, you know, too.
Right. Well, you know, I think the books, again, there's this thing of structure that the books seem to have and have before, and I find them eminently readable to this point without a problem.
Yeah.
And they're not gouging you for shitloads of money, which is really cool. You don't have to buy anything you don't want to. And it's only $2.99, so it's not that big a risk for an experiment. But overall, they get a pass. And Detective and Action are both fine Superman titles. I mean, again, there's so much online shit about how Superman gets interpreted. And I really don't want to get into that because I really don't care. But the accessibility is fine, okay?
Yes, the accessibility this time is, and that was the problem with New 52 is whoever was telling them what was accessible was wrong. That's just how you put it. Whoever told them what would make the characters accessible in New 52, they were wrong.
Right, exactly. There's a really good scene in Action, I think maybe it is, I forget, but I might, yeah, because it's Gleason illustrating it. Is they use the Superman of another Earth to continue the story, and he's got Lois for a wife, and he's got a son named John. And one day, John looks out his window, and he sees his dad looking in the yard, meeting with Batman and Wonder Woman, and they both hear him, and they look up, and they both, all of them have red eyes, just because of the way the sky is lit and everything. And it's one creepy-ass moment. Fully accessible. But for that, enjoy. That's all I can say. We'll check in another month. We'll see what happens.
All right.
Anyway,
Al Vernon's going to talk about his trade paperbacks.
Well, there's only one I've got. Is it Dark Horse? I think it's Dark Horse. God, forgive me if I'm wrong. But it's the reprint of the Fafford and Gray Barbarian, or Gray Martin stories by Fritz Leifer. These were originally packaged when I was a kid under DC and under a title called Weird World. And, man, they have got some big names illustrating these wonderful sword and sorcery classics. You got Walt Simonson when he's just breaking into the business. You got Howard Chaykin when he's just breaking into the business. You got Jim Starlin when he's just breaking into the business. And you got some young writers as well adapting Fritz Leiber stories. And they are fun. Andrew and I frequently harp about the short story format or the done-in-one format. This is it. These guys had like 22 pages, and what they would do is a 17-page story that did the whole story, and then it was like a 5-page quickie or something like that. And it was just an absolute wonderful time. Weird Worlds only ran for, oh God, I should do my research, but this job doesn't pay, so I'm really sorry about that. I'm going to say half a dozen issues, and it was just a scrumptious sword and sorcery title by really inspired people at that time that got this stuff. And DC was lucky enough to get the rights to develop stories to publish it. So, that said, if you are a lover of this kind of material, the Fafford and Gray Malzer Volume 1 stories are just scrumptious, and you should put them on your library if you own this kind of stuff. Wonderful stuff. What do we move now, Kemosabe?
We're going to TV.
Man, I watch TV, but not too much because it's the dead season right now. What are we going to talk about on the TV now?
We were gonna catch up and finish up on. We never talked about Flash and Supergirl.
You know, it's an interesting thing because it's amazing how liquid TV is these days. I mean, things can flow and ebb and flow so much, and the finale of the Flash episode where they basically were open-ended about what they could do anything in the next season. Am I right or wrong about that?
Well, I think that, love it or hate it, it's going to be Flashpoint.
Recount for my feeble brain under the influence of many days, what is Flashpoint?
So Flashpoint, which I love that I'm explaining this to you, since I didn't read it, was the transition to the New 52 when Barry Allen goes back in time to save his mother's life from whoever killed her, killing her.
Oh my God, I was really getting into the jaded comic book retailer you see on The Simpsons by this point, probably.
So, you know, they're kind of promising this for the thing. It was kind of a limp finale. I mean, it's like everybody was like, oh, it's so, you know, he races Zoom and then Zoom gets taken off and you're just like, and then the series sort of resets and it's just like, well.
And they could do anything. That's the thing.
We'll see what they do. I mean, it's just not a very exciting finish to the season.
No. It doesn't bring the dynamism that makes you want to bring to the next series three at all. And, you know, I'm just pissed off about his mom. I'm like, dude, haven't you been warned like 3 million fucking times?
Well, and they finally put him and Iris together, right? They finally get these two characters the level of chemistry that you want to see them having their Ralph and, what's her name, Elongated Man, Ralph and Sue Dibney sort of bickering. On a weekly basis, you know, you want to see Lois know that Superman is Clark and they fight with each other.
Development of the plot.
It would just be cute. You know, like, they fuck that. Okay, so yeah, this episode is just called the fuck episode. They fuck that up, too.
Right. Him and Barry, or her and Barry on the porch. It's like
it's like this cheesy scene, but you know what the truth is? We have been waiting 2 years to see them kiss like this.
Yes.
You know, like, we have, you know, Barry finally got, you know, like, yeah, it worked out for them both. Like,
it's still too creepy, him growing up with Iris and everything for me. I can't get it. It's got too much Freudian shit going on.
He won't anymore, Vernon, next season. And it's just like, the problem is, the other thing is, all right, and the other thing is they kill off his dad, and then find out that the real Jay Garrick is played by the same actor.
It's a Deus Ex Machina or whatever they call it.
Yeah, right? So I mean, it's like, it's cute if you're a fan of John Wesley Shipp. It's cute no matter what. But the problem is, it shows too much of how the show is structured in story arcs, because John Wesley Shipp showed up out of nowhere, you know, in the last three episodes. They sort of shoehorned him in. And it's this, you know, that episode where he goes into the Speed Force is sort of where it started having problems. The second season,
right, they make him a god. Being, or at least he knows godlike beings.
Yeah, he knows Q. It's just, it's not what you wanted from Flash, because Flash did the wonderful thing of always delivering in the first season.
Yeah.
He struggles, but he delivers. And
right.
So this is just like, so now we're just resetting the character's maturity level.
And, you know, the self-righteousness of rewriting your own history is just so weird and creepy. It's like, it's taken him a step down as a character, you know? I mean, you're like,
you just don't, yeah. I mean,
right.
It's just,
like when Peter Parker picks Aunt May over his wife, Mary Jane, in comics, you're like, wait a minute, it's just wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very weird, so we'll see what they do. I imagine we'll have lots of guest stars because, you know, they're going to a new future. And things like that, and, you know, it's all very hush-hush, but yeah, I just want to get the show back going. Like, I just want to, you know, I just want...
Don't forget the elements that kept us interested, you know?
Right, like, you know, you guys still need to figure out how to keep Harrison Wells on the show, like...
Oh, yeah, exactly. Why did he leave, exactly?
Yeah, and Cisco needs a girlfriend, and, you know, we gotta do this. So you had things that we needed to do, like...
They be around, you know.
Yeah, they miss, it seems like they didn't understand their audience. That, yeah,
quite possible. Well, that's one thing, but just not having the right direction to why you want to finish off the season. It's like, you know, there's a lot of different ways you could have done this, and just having him self-serve himself like that, and, like, leave the door open, and, like, the whole scene with him and Iris was odd. I mean, you're trying to establish them as a couple, but at the same time, you're doing everything you can to keep apart. It's kind of odd after 2 years. We're either gonna advance with this or we're gonna let it go. That's what you got to do with that Barry Iris thing. You're either gonna say, well, we're either the couple or we're not. But to leave us hanging like that is just
weird.
They're
gonna put it off for another fucking season. They're gonna do it.
Right, and you don't want it that way because they've been talking about it for 2 years. I'm like, okay, well,
they finally proved their point. They finally proved. This season, they proved that she works as her own character after they screwed her over the whole first season. She got to be the shitty reporter. She got to be the shitty DC Comics girlfriend reporter who can't figure anything out.
It was awful. Her role at the newspaper was awful. It was just, they looked tired of the black chick.
Right. Who knows The Flash? Who has a blog? Yeah. I mean, it was fucking terrible. Like,
exactly.
It was like it's like some guy read, like, oh my god, look at this. Black people get exploited online.
Right. So they give her a black boss, and then what does he do? He dates her.
And through it all, she became like this character that everybody really liked, and they fucked that up. And it's just like, so what? She's going to be mad at Barry for most of third season. Maybe she'll have another boyfriend, and then, you know, so.
Maybe it's a two-season show, I hate to say it, but.
I'm not willing to go that far yet, but it's certainly, in hindsight, it disappointed me more than I thought it did. Like, I was generally okay with it until, like, I thought about it. And then I realized just how.
And that's a problem because I was very similar. Like, when I watched the end episode, I was like, it's okay. It's acceptable. But the more I sat there and thought about it, you know, it was so non-spectacular that I'm kind of annoyed that they
didn't do anything that The Flash needs to do.
Yeah, it didn't make me want to come back for season 3, and that was the biggest thing, you know? I mean, I'm not excited about the next season here at all.
In contrast, like, it's kind of like the end. Did you finish Daredevil season 2?
Yes.
I fucking hated the last two episodes of that. But I felt like the production values were a lot lower with the action scenes. Punisher being green screened in. Like, Karen Page's terrible article that she read out loud. Like, I just felt like they didn't actually have enough story, and they just need to get him to a certain point to be ready for Defenders next year, whenever the fuck it is.
Yeah.
And it's like, until then, I mean, the Karen Page, Frank Castle stuff is amazing.
It is.
And I mean, so it needed to be amazing. It didn't need to be Frank Castle going, I got a shirt. I'm the Punisher. Here's my bazooka. Go get him, Red. Like, you know.
He gives him depth.
Yeah, it's like, it gets a pass because I want to see what, because in no small part because, you know, Jessica Jones was great. So, like, you assume that this brand, this network, this sub-network can come through for it. But with The Flash, no, the only other, you know, thing we have to base success on is Arrow, which nobody enjoys watching anymore.
It's a toughie.
Nobody watch it. If you watch it, all you do is talk shit about it. Like, nobody seems to like it. And it's like, that's all we have. You know, The Flash needs to convince us it will never do that.
You know, it's amazing, too, that after, like, that second year, like, well, like, what are you going to bring? I mean, this, like, in the first couple episodes, I'm going to know whether or not I'm going to keep going with this or not. And so it's a big burden on the Flash people to keep me watching after the first one. And then even the second episode, like, that's going to be like the end if the first one didn't do it. So God help them. I mean, but, you know, I want the show to succeed. You just don't want to succeed because of the wrong reasons anyway, you know?
Well, I don't think it can. I mean, nobody liked this. This is not a move that impressed anyone. Nobody's excited about this.
What is it? In TV land, what do they do? Do they replace the producer or something like that?
They'll never do that. I would assume they change the writer room a little bit. And I mean, it's been a rough writer room this season. The last three or four episodes have been pretty weak. They've not been great.
Yeah. No kidding. I mean, the Kevin Smith episode.
Smith one is the one that I'm just like.
Well, they changed the rules with the Kevin Smith episode where they make him. He doesn't become a godlike being, but he is among godlike beings.
Right,
you know?
He has no concern. Yeah, I mean, it's
weird. I mean, if he had a point to it, maybe, but there was no point toward any of it. You know, are you going to rescue your mom or not? You do, and I'm like, well, isn't that what they told you? That
So that's the Flash. Now, Supergirl's moving to CW, so it got renewed and picked up on a different network. So. 1 year from now, we will have all seen a four-part crossover between Arrow, The Flash, Legends of Tomorrow, and Supergirl.
You know what? That may not be a bad thing for Supergirl to be on the WB network. I mean, if it gets to hold a budget, I don't know. Is it going to lose a lot of its budget moving over to the
WB? No, it's not. I think they're making it up with Canada. Yeah, and...
Although my favorite actress may not want to do a show... In Canada. What's her name? Her boss or whatever.
I don't know. She's coming.
Yeah.
I mean, I assume they've made some changes. They just announced today that CW shows are going to start airing on Netflix a week after their season finale.
Okay, fair enough.
So I'm thinking that they're trying to, after last year when the CW said they didn't want to be thought of as the DC Comics network, I think that at this point they kind of do.
Well, why would you? If you get a corner market, well,
that
properties, what the fuck?
Yeah, that Warner's seeing these properties as the equivalent of the sort of Netflix Marvel.
Well, you and I have had many discussions about TV, kind of in a way, much a quicker model to adapt, change, and capture the mood of what needs to be done on a much more efficient and less costly scale.
Yes.
No, I mean, that's it. TV is the future, I think, in many ways, of Marvel and DC, anyway.
Yeah. So,
movies are something else, yeah.
Movies are something else, and it seems like a good sign. And somebody said that CBS came out and said they would have renewed Supergirl anyway, but...
Demographic wasn't, like, younger people.
That's the thing is that it was a weird pickup. It didn't make sense by the time it made sense when they were bidding on it, but then there was a whole year before the pilot even aired. So it was too weird of a fit. And I think that, you know, I'm going to watch it now. I've only seen the pilot.
Really?
Yeah. We're going to watch it though.
You gotta go past three or four episodes before it starts adding characters.
That's what I heard.
Yeah, the first few are tough. The Bizarro Girl, that's a good one. And the stuff with Martian Manhunter is good.
Yeah.
And it's worth watching, but like, you know, it's so funny. My wife and I have such arguments because she's kind of a Downton Abbey person. And she goes, oh my God, you're not going to watch Supergirl again. And I'm like, well, just turn your brain off. Don't try to put logic onto it, and you're just fine, you know? Let it go.
Let it go.
Of all the WB superhero shows, it is the lightest for logic. Remember that, and you'll be fine. But
now,
one thing we will finish off was, you and I are both latecomers to a particular show
we've been
watching lately.
When did you start watching it?
Well, my kid and her husband, I'm still referring to him as my husband, that's why. I will say...
Your son-in-law, Vernon.
My son-in-law now, yeah. My daughter got married last weekend, the July the 3rd, and it was great. We had a great time, and I've got a son-in-law now, and he loves Game of Thrones. So for Christmas, we gave him the first season is when the tchotchke gets... And he, like, went and bought all the rest of them, and they're still waiting for the – like many other people, they're waiting for the sixth season now to be collected so they can buy that. And Gene and I, we just borrowed it from him. That's how we got into the game. How about yourself? What got you finally in the game?
The wife. People were telling the wife to watch it. So
it was such cooler talk that she had to break down.
So finally, yeah, we started watching it. We're three episodes into the second season.
Okay, Gene and I finished the second season, and we're just starting the third season.
All right.
And so we're not gonna give spoilers to each other, but there's pluses and minuses. I mean, it's fairly genre material. Like, I grew up reading like Sword and Sorcery.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's
still nothing new under the sun here. You know, it's a soap opera. It's how well it
does. Yeah, it's the first. I'm liking the second season more than the first.
The second season, yeah, it picks up a little bit. And
the first season was too. You know, I was thinking about it, is that you had Mark Addy and you had Sean Bean in the first season, and you could take it too fucking seriously.
Well,
you could take Sean Bean brought enough gravity to it that you could sort of take it too seriously. Like, you bought his concern. You forgot that you were watching a soap opera, right? And Mark Addy is the king.
Right.
Like, they had a thing going that was, you know. So in the second season, when all it really is all of these little plot threads moving.
Yeah, so far, yeah.
It just works. Like, you're just like, ah, that's fine. Like, nobody you don't like is around for too long. Like,
yeah. You're wondering because, like, okay, the one of the tricks is don't fall in love with anybody because it's Game of Thrones and anything can happen.
Right.
I'm like, yeah, yes and no. Stupid characters die for dramatic effect, but they're not going to affect the plot later, so that's why they die. Okay, it's a dramatic thing to happen.
Right.
So they have a dramatic thing to happen, which is fine. I mean, there's some elements about it. God, I don't, you know, talking without spoilers here is tough, but nonetheless, it's fine soap opera. I'm not really impressed by they make a big battle scene when, what is it, King's Throne or whatever the fuck the name of the city is, gets attacked by the king's brother's forces. It makes cheap production.
Oh, joy.
Oh, it's funny, the battle for the wall. When you get to the battle for the wall, when the ships come in, look for this, and count how cheap this is done. It is.
That's kind of the thing with it. Yeah, I mean, it's weird because it's like it.
Look, wait, and I'll say one more thing. Right. Look for the king being the first one on the ladder, on the first ladder to climb the wall. Right. I'm looking at my wife. I'm like, why is the king the first guy on the first ladder of the fucking wall? That makes no sense whatsoever. You know. But anyway, I'll leave it at that. What are your impressions so far, sir?
I mean, I did not like much of the first season.
Well,
it just
so vulnerable. Like, it told you that, okay, you thought this is about the Starks. It really isn't, okay? Starks are a big part of it, obviously. But their kingdom is pretty much decimated with the death of Ned Stark or whatever the fuck his name was.
I mean, the other thing was is that I guess I have a lot of issues with the fantasy elements and things like that. Just,
yeah, I was kind of disappointed when the fantasy elements worked their way into it. I go, you know, it almost seems like cheating when you bring the supernatural into something.
Well, yeah, and I mean, just like the whole, you know, this is a thousands-year-old civilization, but they're really only about 500, 600 years along. Like, the wall's too old for them to have built it and still be at this level of civilization. Like, we would have there would have been some sort of development, even if there hadn't been an industrial revolution or something. It's shit like that bothers me.
Right, it does deny the Industrial Revolution.
It denies that, you know, a civilization that's been around this long should have, you know, some, you know, relative... They should know whether or not dragons were really fucking real or not. Like, it's an argument, you know? Even though the viewer knows they're real, other people are like, nah, there were dragons. And it's just like, there are fucking dragon bones in the basement. You know, like, really? There aren't dragons. Like,
the plot with the dragons continues on, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, and that was one of the biggest things. I didn't mean to interrupt, but, like, when you're trying to look at media and you're trying to screen out Game of Thrones, it's incredibly, incredibly hard. And I've not read anything and I've not been caught, but every once in a while you'll see a picture, right? And you're like, well, fuck, it's this season, if there's a picture of this character, I'm to assume that they've lived and
continued. They've made it, yeah.
And I'm like, well, they shouldn't even show pictures, you know, right now for us poor newbies. But I don't know. I'll probably finish it off because my wife is into it, you know.
I feel like the second season has hit at least, like, they're playing up the soap opera aspect more. They've toned down the sort
super
of
big time.
They've toned down the, you know, ambition of the narrative ambition.
The narrative ambition got ratcheted back a bit here, right? Definitely.
So, I mean, like, I'm enjoying that aspect. I mean, you know,
right? It's well done. Like even though the big
yeah, I mean, it's always like incredibly competently produced. Like. Yeah. It's right, never, right. Like, no acting is bad.
Right.
None of it's really great, but, like, there's nobody who's bad on it. Like,
no, there's right nobody that jars you to reality on
it. Right. That. You know, it's, you know, it I can see it being maybe really good if somebody, no, but... I don't know. Like, it doesn't secretly have a level of depth like Downton Abbey does. Like, Downton Abbey...
The people get mad at me, and I go, well, Downton Abbey has, like, a level of detail that's based on reality that you really got... It's like, it adds another layer to.
Right, so, I mean, it's really... Downton Abbey was really responsible with, like... what it could do with its characters, right? Like, and like treating them, like looking at them carefully and not treating them like caricatures.
Right. Or advancements to the plot.
Right. Game of Thrones doesn't do any of that. Like, yeah. And, but the thing is, it's so on the nose about it. Game of Thrones is basically like watching the Hunger Games at this point, or it's like about watching like Battle Royale. It is waiting for someone to die.
Right, and right, because every time like it cuts to a new scene, you stand on grisly edge waiting for something bad to happen.
Right. And the first season established anyone can die, and so as long as they keep that going, you know, as long as they kill off a major enough character every once in a while,
when they kill Ned Stark at the end of the first season, okay, that's a big dramatic happening,
yeah.
And it also says something about their adherence to characters, like
right.
Before to this point, we've been okay with characters.
Well, they killed the king, and I feel like that was like the big surprise because I didn't realize the king died, even though I knew that Sean Bean died.
Yeah.
Going into it, I didn't know that the king died, and I feel like that was a real surprise. Like, they're like, oh, we can even kill the king, and then we're going to kill Ned Stark. Like, after telling you for a whole episode, we're not.
Well, it was weird to see them both die.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that they both died, it's like, well, okay, I was ready for the king, but you should have kept Ned Stark around for another season, maybe, or
right.
Something.
It's a very, like, sort of mini-series approach to a TV show, which
right.
You just haven't seen done this slickly. Like,
yeah.
It's so slick.
I'm not sure. It's kind of funny. They make some missteps in season three. I'm two episodes into three. And they're logical missteps again. And again, they take battle scenes for things they can use to wrap the logic around to develop their plot. I'm like, well, wait a minute, this is not how this would happen because you've ignored this. Okay, so I'm like, I'm not a battle guy particularly. And you know, sometimes there's something to be said for too much detail. But no, you just can't. It's like
right.
Japanese anime. You just can't impose a story on me. Want me to accept it anyway? But it's kind of nice. We'll try to keep up our slow pace with getting
yes.
together anyway. And for those, I'm sure all of our listeners are way beyond us.
Yeah, nobody's starting. We're late starters. I didn't think I was going to bother. So
it might be fascinating to listen to our slow progress up the series.
Yes, we'll keep talking about it. But it's going to be hard to get me to watch Walking Dead, so don't try.
Don't even try to Walking Dead. I don't even so don't even buy that shit.
All right, so I guess that's it.
We kept it very nominal.
We did. We did pretty good. Hopefully, we'll be able to work out another show next month. It's all dependent on schedules right now.
That's true.
So we'll see if we can get another one out. But until then, there hasn't been this good of a time to read superhero comics in 6 years.
Yeah, at least since you moved out of here, yeah.
I mean, it's been a long time since, you know, anybody could just be like, sure you could buy a Batman comic. Go for it.
Right, $2.99, who gives a fuck for $3?
Yeah, ooh, yeah, you want to read Teen Titans. Sure you do. Fuck do I care? Like, DC Rebirth, out of nowhere, you know, they succeeded to be mediocre. Like,
well, you know, you with the proper help, you can read anything. I mean, there's just too many good titles to read. You don't have time to read them all.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thing but there's a lot of good books coming out, and I wanted to get these read, but I haven't had a chance yet, but I will be reading them. And probably talking about them on Comics Fondle, and then I'll send them on to Vernon if they're for the. We should talk about them on the podcast, but it's fan comics. Have you heard? Fan comics, full length fan comics that people are releasing since, you know, the internet's big enough now that you can really put as much effort into releasing your own indie fan comic as you would your indie image book or Oni book. And so there's a Spider-Man one out that I want to check out. It's an established, employed comics creator doing a side fan project.
Wow.
Yeah.
If there's something that impresses you that you want to send to me,
I'm gonna look into that, because that's kind of an interesting thing, because we've seen, for the worse, frankly, in the last 10 years, as comics have become more popular overall, we've seen a lot less interesting self-published stuff.
Yes, a lot less interesting. It's amazing that in the era of making it so easy to get your stuff out there and spread, that there's really nothing to spread.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, the internet is so big that we wouldn't necessarily know some good web comic, and we'll never know. It will never end up on Vernon's doorstep as, you know, a solicitation, like Reich, for example. Remember?
God. Us and what, the 35 other people that read Reich?
I don't know. And Reich was a great fucking book. Like,
it was. For 4 or 5 issues, it was the tits.
Yeah, and I mean, like, what? I don't even remember his name.
Me neither, but that's not our fault.
And so, yeah, and it's like, if the guy who's doing Reich is not currently doing Reich because, you know, he's got to make a living, but.
Well, comics are filled with names of people that were in and out of it over a period of time just to satisfy either a creative urge or a psychological discharge.
Yeah, and we just have not seen indie comics. Indie comics, you know. Actually, when you think about it, digital kind of killed indie comics. Digital didn't kill comics, but digital did kill self-published comics.
Well, it hurt them a lot. I mean, other than guys like Kevin Huizenga, there ain't a whole lot of
And Huizenga's distributed through Fantagraphics. So, you know, Huizenga's not the example that he was, you know, 20 years ago.
Right, that's true.
But everybody should go read some Huizenga because he's amazing. But anyway, so the positive is that the wrap-up is it seems like the web is going to start being used to distribute maybe some interesting indie work. Well, like actual indie work and not, you know, Image. Image is not indie. You know, there are no, we don't read any indie comics. Like, Oni's not an indie press anymore.
Yeah, forget that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's over that way, but yeah, so I'll check it out. I'll pass it on to Vernon, and it seems exciting.
Anything that comes our way, we'll certainly push it out. That's for damn sure.
That's about it. I guess I'm going to go watch some Game of Thrones, and you're going to...
I'm going to drive home safely.
Of course he is, everyone. We're just recording this. All right. So, yeah, hopefully we'll have an August episode. So we'll try our best.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there's, like I say, there's still too many good things. It goes up and down. As a retailer, I would tell you that publishing has its ups and downs, and Wolf in what happens after the Marvel and DC Game of Thrones continues, as it were.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, kids. Bye.